We are here today with Professor Nina Tannenwalt, Director of the International Relations Program at Brown University and Professor in the Political Science Department. Thanks for being here with us.
My pleasure.
Our first question is, under international law, how is the world supposed to hold the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria accountable for its massive human rights violations?
So that's a very good question, and international law is very murky on this issue. There is international law dealing with the right of individual and collective self-defense, but it's quite unclear how it applies, and so there's quite a debate right now among legal scholars and pundits over what would be the legal justification for the U.S. use of force. Now, let me say first, though, that I think the starting point for this is that ISIS is now, it's not simply a terrorist organization. It's a military fighting force that is holding territory. And so one can, the states on whose territory it is fighting, can fight back and kill them. So Iraq and Syria can legitimately fight against ISIS and can legitimately kill their fighters. So the first thing to say here is we're not in a paradigm of law enforcement, right, where we have to sort of arrest them and try them. This is the paradigm of armed conflict, and they can actually be killed. If Iraq or Syria, let's just start with them, did capture any of their leaders or any of their soldiers, they could be tried for war crimes. But we are in a situation of armed conflict, so they can be killed. What's the international legal justification for the U.S. use of force? So we are planning to engage in airstrikes. And here, I think we have a stronger case in Iraq. The domestic argument is Obama, President Obama, saying we have the right to do this under the 2002 authorization for the use of military force. But what's the international legal rationale? And here, one argument is that it's collective self-defense, that Iraq has asked us to assist them in their fight against ISIS. So that's, one could make that argument. The Syria case is harder. So if we go in to bomb Syria, Syria hasn't asked for our help. So collective self-defense doesn't really work there. We could argue we have the right of individual self-defense under the Article 51 of the UN Charter. We would have to claim that Syria is unwilling or unable to fight ISIS themselves, but they've proclaimed themselves willing. So it's a little tenuous. My own view is that we should move toward a UN Security Council resolution, which would bring the international community together, so this to make it a collective security action.
You mentioned that the U.S. was invited by Iraq. Would that mean that the coalition that the U.S. has formed would also be included in that invitation?
Yes, so presumably the coalition would be invited, and that would be a legitimate use of force because the coalition is assisting Iraq, which has requested this assistance.
Great. So could you tell me a little bit more about which projects you personally are working on this semester?
Well, I work in two areas. One is on nuclear weapons and nonproliferation, and so I'm working on a paper on a normative strategy for disarmament, sort of how do we delegitimize nuclear weapons, increase support for nuclear disarmament. I have a couple other nuclear-related projects. And then the other area that I work on is the laws of war and human rights. And so I'm just in the final stages of editing, of an edited book project on how the Geneva Conventions matter. So this looks at different cases where states have faced non-state actors and really looking very closely, very empirically at whether the Geneva Conventions, the laws of war, influenced states' behavior on the ground. That is, can we really trace concretely that these norms, these laws have influenced and constrained states' behavior? And so we have a bunch of experts writing on different historical cases, and I've written the kind of framing theoretical chapter for that. And then I'm also working in the final stages of a paper on targeted killings.
Wow.
So in changing norms about the use of force and sort of whether targeted killing is becoming a new norm, the international system, an acceptable way to fight terrorists.
What changes should we expect to the International Relations Department since your appointment as the new head this summer?
Well, I hope many good things. let me highlight three things. The first is I want to kind of beef up the mid-level offerings in security. So part of what's going on at the Watson Institute is strengthening our general presence in our research work on international security issues, global security, security seen from a variety of perspectives, and that will, I want that to translate into the curriculum of the IR concentration. The second thing is increasing experiential opportunities, and there are two here. One is internships, so thinking about how we can increase internship opportunities for IR students. This doesn't mean that you will get credit for them, but the experience is what's important, and so I'll be working on that. And the other part of the experiential focus is to bring into our curriculum some relatively sophisticated simulations and role-playing experiences. So these may be built into a course, or they may be kind of standalone things that will run, for example, across a week or several weeks and so on, require a significant amount of preparation. So it's somewhat like Model UN, but it'll be focused for IR students generally.
Great. That's very interesting. We look forward to seeing what comes out of that.
Thank you.